Hello there and welcome to another episode of Marketing Room 101. I'm Ben Norman, Strategy Director at Principles in Leeds, and this is the podcast where I invite marketers for a good old rant and give them the chance to banish one thing from the industry forever. I'm particularly excited today because this is the 10th episode, and to be honest, I expected that probably about as much as you did. I'm also excited because I've got a really great guest. In this episode, I bring to you the antidote to shoddy thinking, the man driven by a purpose to dispel brand purpose, the northerner who wrote The Road to Hell. Yes, Mr. Nick Asprey. Sorry if any of you thought it was going to be Chris Rea. I first discovered Nick when Paul Feldwick told me to look him up, and then reading Nick's book was a truly cathartic experience. It sort of felt like somebody had taken all the frustrations I have about nonsensical, purpose-led marketing, made sense of them, and then laid it all out in a very potent, very proper, and very human antithesis that marketers and advertisers simply can't ignore. I very much enjoyed this conversation and hope you do too. Nick, welcome to Marketing Room 101.
Hello, Ben. It's great to be here.
So to get us started, Nick, could you please set the scene and just let our listeners know what it's actually like in here in Marketing Room 101?
Yeah, I'll do my best. I think I'm in a WeWork building in a meeting room, and their purpose statement, Elevate the World's Consciousness, is emblazoned across the wall. There's a drinks machine serving only Pepsi, which has a life-size cutout of Kendall Jenner next to it, holding a placard saying the conversation. The room is full of management consultants wearing Patagonia gilets, discussing their ESG ratings while the streets outside are on fire. And one of them is eating from a giant jar of Hellmann's mayonnaise in an attempt to reduce food waste. It's a very horrible room and I want to go home.
Out of interest, are they eating more mayonnaise to try and reduce the food waste?
Yeah, Hellmann's purpose is to make taste, not waste, by manufacturing 1,000 jars of mayonnaise every minute, I think the stat is. But yeah, somehow they've convinced themselves that putting more of this gloop into the world will actually reduce food waste rather than potentially increase it. So yeah, you can see I've got straight on to my purpose hobby horse.
I think the irony in all that being, the one thing Hellmann's could do to reduce food waste is make it possible to get the last 10% of the mayo out of the bottle. I suppose the last thing on that, what do you think WeWork are doing actively to help elevate the world's consciousness?
Well, God, they've had an interesting story over the last decade or so. I mean, I tend to use them as probably the most comedic example of a purpose statement, you know, to elevate the world's consciousness, which sounds like a parody, but it genuinely is what their purpose was. And Adam Newman, who was the founder of WeWork, he was, kind of a guru-like figure. He seemed to hold himself as though he was leading a religion or something, but a bit like those kind of cult figures that you see, he led a very, very kind of hedonistic lifestyle, I think, which was all funded by the company and its kind of culture of overworking most of its staff. But yeah, at the end of the day, they're an office letting company and they came crashing to earth. I think he kind of seemed to manage to avoid the consequences.
So Nick, I wanted to invite you into Marketing Room 101 for a few reasons. Firstly, Paul Feldwick, who was my first ever guest, highly recommended you. But also, most importantly, you have recently written an interesting book. You've written The Road to Hell, How Purposeful Business Leads to Bad Marketing and a Worse World. Strong title, strong statement. But of this book, Professor Byron Sharp himself, the hardest man to please in marketing, perhaps, said, "It is an antidote to shoddy thinking. It's calm, measured, grown up, and very well written. It's entertaining too." What would you like to say about that?
Well, yeah, I'm quite proud of having that quote on the back cover because, yeah, as you say, Byron isn't the easiest man to please, I don't think. I think he's a brilliant thinker about the industry and about marketing effectiveness. So yeah, he was on, I drew up a list of people I would ideally like to get quotes from, and he was probably the first name on the list. And I was delighted when he read it and decided it was worthy of comment.
So I've got an inkling we may cover brand purpose, perhaps more later, but there was one point in the book that really stuck with me where you suggest that individuals can be brimming with their own individual purpose. And nothing in your book suggests anything other than purpose potentially being a very important part of people's lives, but they just don't need their employer to tell them what it is. The example you use in the book of a window cleaner tells the story incredibly well. And it's a beautiful story about a window cleaner in Manhattan. And I think for me, that captured that sentiment really, really well. And I just wondered if you could share a little bit of that now.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you asked because, well, first of all, it's a part of the book that I don't think anyone else has brought up. And yeah, I do think it's an important one. And it's always the first point I try to make in this whole argument is that to argue against brand purpose isn't to argue against personal purpose. And I actually think, you know, on a personal human level, purpose is a very deep thing. And yeah, I mentioned this story of a guy called Rocco Camarche, I think you pronounce his name. And he was a window cleaner on the World Trade Center. And he was interviewed in the Sunday Times, used to do a kind of life in the day column, I think, in their magazine. And yeah, I've got the quote here. This is Rocco Camarche just talking about his work and what he likes about it. My world consists of windows and reflections. I prefer to be on the outside looking in. I'm the one who's free. Inside, it's like a jail. I wouldn't ever want to change places with the big shots sitting inside in their leather chairs. As I pass their air-conditioned cages, I can see they'd love to rip off their ties. Me, I don't have any stress. It's pretty hellish up there when the wind whips around, though the cage is rock solid. But I've often come off the building with windburn. In summer, there's a nice, spidery breeze. But I love this job. I get $75 more than the window cleaners downstairs. And the sad coda to that is that he was there on 9/11 and his body was never found. So, you know, he died doing the work that he loved. But yeah, I just find that a very poetic, moving quote about how any job, whether it's window cleaning or copywriting or whatever it is, it can mean a lot to a person. And I absolutely would stand for that idea. And equally, people do find meaning outside their work. You know, they see it as a means to an end. They do the 9-to-5, they earn a decent living, and then they go off and, you know, raise a family or do community work or support their local football team or, you know, whatever it is. But we all find purpose in our own ways.
You also reference Maya Angelou and a few others who escaped me. The people that find purpose despite their work as well. And I thought that was a really interesting point. Some people, like a window cleaner on the World Trade Center, can find absolute purpose in their work. But equally, there are people who find absolutely no purpose in their work, but are deeply purpose-driven individuals.
Yeah, I do mention a kind of list of people. Robert Burns, the poet, was a tax collector. Charlotte Bronte was a governess. Kurt Vonnegut managed a Saab dealership. Jeff Koops was a commodities broker. But yeah, the idea of them having to deal with their employer's purpose statement is just slightly comical, I think, because obviously they've got huge purposes of their own. And I actually say, because towards the end of the book, I think the one of the reasons I wrote it is that I actually think purpose is a really deep idea and it's too important to let corporations and brands kind of take it over. So yeah, that's where I'm coming from with all this.
This podcast is not sponsored by Principles Agency. If it was, I certainly wouldn't be allowed the tangential indulgence of asking guests my brother's random questions. But as it's where I work and they give me and everybody else a free day off every week, which I spend doing this, I feel obliged to give it a plug. At Principles, we're obsessed with the word unforgettable, meaning we help everyday brands come to mind quicker and stay there longer. We do this using a set of principles the team and I developed. This means making brands distinctive, entertaining, visible, and consistent. If you'd like to chat about how we can help you with any brand creation, brand activation, or brand building project, just pop me, Ben Norman, or Principles Agency a message on LinkedIn, or head to principlesagency.co.uk.
I guess we might have touched on a little bit already, but you're joining me today in Marketing Room 101 because you would like to banish something from the marketing world forever. Could you please reveal what you would like to banish, please?
Well, to the immense surprise of listeners, yeah, I would indeed love to banish purpose. And that is purpose with a capital P in the special sense that it's kind of taken on in the marketing and branding world in recent years. I think, as we've already discussed, there's no sense in which I would like to consign lowercase purpose to Room 101. I think it's a vitally important thing. But I think this brand purpose or this kind of social purpose school of thought that has been dominant for the last, I would say, 15 years. It would be very nice if we could consign it in this conversation and then I can go off and live my life.
You'd have nothing to do though, Nick, I don't think. Or maybe you'd go do some great work for brands and not have to write the books about it. So for the sake of us defining this thing that we're going to banish into Marketing Room 101, you mentioned there about little P purpose and big P purpose. And that's something that gets used quite a lot. For the sake of listeners, could you just define what do you mean when you say little P purpose versus big P purpose?
Yeah. Well, I'm unfortunately old enough to remember what the industry was like before this kind of purpose word entered the conversation. We used to have lots of different words that would define the kind of essence of a company or a brand. You know, you might talk about their mission or their essence or their values or their positioning. You would have like brand pyramids and brand onions and all sorts of things that people would try and use to say, well, you know, we're a brand, we need to know what we're about, we need to know what we want people to think of us. And I think lower P purpose you could put in that bucket in a way. It's just another word for that brand, just basically knowing what it's about and getting on with it. The new thing that came along, I would say, post 2008 was this idea of uppercase purpose, which was that a brand needs to stand for something higher in terms of delivering some kind of societal benefit. And this was the kind of key claim that made purpose feel like a kind of new thing. And, you know, the slogan of that movement really was do well by doing good. It was this idea that if you do good things as a brand, you will get rewarded in the marketplace and become the dominant brand. And I think that's a nice sounding philosophy. It would be kind of convenient if it was true. But I think, unfortunately, that's not really how business works. Hopefully that gets across this distinction that I would say there's always been between kind of uppercase purpose and lowercase.
So if we focus in on big P purpose, how does that lead to bad marketing and a worse world? And that's a big question because you've covered that in depth in the book. And I would strongly recommend anybody who wants to know more about this, do read the book. But in a nutshell, what is it about big P purpose that is the danger to marketers?
Yeah, well, first of all, on the marketing front, fundamentally, I think purpose is built on an exaggeration or a kind of mistruth, really, which is that the true purpose of a for-profit business can actually be social benefit rather than profit. The clue is in that phrase, for-profit rather than not-for-profit. So I think you're starting from a kind of questionable claim and then you're building your brand on that. You know, I kind of go through the dynamics of how that plays out in the book. I think one thing it does is it pushes businesses in a very similar direction. I think it does ultimately turn every business into a different version of we're here to make the world a better place, to do it by selling coffee or selling washing powder or selling whatever it is. And that almost the job of a creative agency has become, right, how can we tie some kind of knot between a social cause and how can we somehow tie this to our soft drink? So it does actually make the marketing more generic. I think it's also based on inward-looking mindset as well. I've actually, you know, as my day job as a copywriter, I've been involved sometimes against my will in coming up with these purpose statements for brands. And I think, you know, they spend months looking inwards, trying to gaze at their own navels, working out, well, what do we stand for? What do we believe? And I think they lose that kind of outward-looking mindset of being interested in their customers and interested in the world. And I think fundamentally as well, on the marketing level, purpose just misunderstands the way customers think and the way they actually buy things. Many customers in opinion surveys will say, yes, I really want to buy from a brand that stands for something. But in reality, not because we're all hypocrites necessarily, but just because the realities of life, we'll buy from brands that are just top of mind and convenient. And Gen Z may very sincerely say, you know, we want to support sustainable brands, but Shein has been the most successful Gen Z brand of the last 10 years. And I don't say that to criticize them. I just think it's part of the reality of living in the real world. We make all sorts of purchasing choices every day, barely even thinking about the brand, let alone thinking about the social or political outlook. So yeah, I think all of that makes the marketing less effective. And then I won't launch into another long answer about how it makes the world worse, but I just think one thing worth highlighting is the very fact that it makes marketing worse actually isn't great for the world. Because, you know, when you run a successful marketing campaign for a decent business and you help them sell more stuff, you've actually done a really good thing. You've helped ensure all the employees of that business have a home to go to and they've all got families to feed, and you've ensured that everyone in the supply chain of that business is actually going to benefit as well. And yeah, you've hopefully helped bring products and services into the world that customers actually want and benefit from on some level. So I don't think people should be ashamed of, like, oh God, all I did was an ad campaign that sold more, you know, washing powder or something. There's nothing wrong with that. And equally, yeah, you can go off and use your skills to do a campaign for cancer research or something. But I just think you need to see the distinction. We can't turn every brief into a social purpose brief.
I think you're 100% right. The way that it levels off creative communications. If you think about all of the potential you have with something as simple as to keep using mayonnaise, if you think of what you could do with Hellman's, if you take the idea as being, make this the best sandwich you've ever had, or something in that sort of direction that is more specific rather than, here's how our mayonnaise helps make the world a better place. You're right. All the roads lead in different directions as opposed to them all leading to the same place, don't they?
Yes.
I think there's something really interesting as well in that idea that our industry thinks that Gen Z is this group that have this shared mindset, super socially conscious, all obsessed with saving the planet, whatever else we might believe that they are.
Yeah.
It's simply not true, is it? You get Gen Z on the far left of politics. You get Gen Z on the far right of politics. You get Gen Z that don't care about the planet. You'll get Gen Z that do in the same that you do in every other age bracket. And yes, there might be slight generational differences, but I don't know if that's one of the big issues at play here, where purpose itself, we believe, is something that is much more important to Gen Zers. But on many of the briefs that I receive, we want to reach 18 to 35 year olds, or we want to reach 18 to 30 year olds. There's this obsession with reaching younger people. I think that could be at play here.
No, I think that's really true. And I think really what you've got are big consultancies like Deloitte or Adelman or McKinsey. They're the people who keep pushing this narrative that Gen Z really wants companies to embrace brand purpose. And that makes me quite suspicious. I kind of think, well, are you sure it's really them that want companies to do this? Or does it just suit your business model? Because I think fundamentally purpose is about business overreaching itself. Whereas you say, Gen Z are just people like anyone else. They have extremely varied views. And that's just the reality, whether you like it or not, really.
I suppose the other thing at play, going back to that point about intent versus action, you can find that 86% of people say they'd rather buy from brands that believe in good causes or that have values that align with them.
Mm.
Of course they would, but you can stick that up in a brand planning meeting and it will carry a lot of weight on the surface. But as you've said there, dig beneath the surface of that. All that says is 14% of people are dicks.
Yeah, you'd have to be pretty bold in a survey to answer otherwise, really, wouldn't you? What we say in surveys and what we buy in the supermarket aisle, they're just poles apart, I think.
Absolutely. So I'm convinced about purpose. So once purpose has been thrown in the bin, once it's trapped down here in Marketing Room 101, what do we need to get back to focusing on?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. And I think one of the fears that underlies all of this is that somehow if we let go of purpose, we'll be in some kind of evil, amoral kind of world where companies are just flogging stuff left, right and centre without a care for anything else. I actually think maybe to use an example close to your heart, given your accent, I think we would end up in a world of more Yorkshire teas. They're a brilliant brand, I think, and have been, you know, throughout this whole purpose era. They've actually done just really charming, really effective, really funny, really sustained, consistent advertising that I think can easily sit up there with the legendary stuff from the 60s, 70s, 80s. You know, I think the Sean Bean ad is just a brilliant 30-second comedy sketch. The Patrick Stewart one is great. The Kaiser Chiefs holding music. They're just brilliant pieces of advertising. And you can imagine what would happen if Yorkshire Tea got kind of purpose-pilled, so to speak. You could easily see how a consultant could say, well, look, it's not really about the tea. It's about bringing people together and it's about community. One way or the other, you would end up with some very high-minded purpose statements and a bunch of quite emotive sob story kind of ads.
You'd end up with something like making the world better cup by cup, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Isn't that the same as Starbucks?
It is. Yeah, it's exactly Starbucks purpose statement.
Yeah.
To make my case, I sometimes pick on bad examples, but it's actually quite nice to pick on a good example like Yorkshire Tea. I do think that's just, it just points to the kind of advertising that is still totally possible without that kind of purpose mindset. You know, towards the end of the book, actually, I mentioned three H's, which I see as being good things to kind of lean towards: humour, humanity and humility. And I kind of go into the reasons why they're related and why I think they're good touchstones. Mm-hmm. But I think Yorkshire Tea tick each of those, really. It's obviously it's humorous. I think there's an obvious humanity to it. They're just very like personal stories. It's rooted in kind of Yorkshire culture. And then the humility in the sense of you prepare to make fun of your own brand in a way. I think a lot of purpose stuff, humour is its biggest enemy because humour bursts the bubble a bit and pricks the pride of a lot of these brands. And, you know, I think if someone had had a sense of humour when WeWork said, okay, our purpose statement is going to be elevate the world's consciousness. You know, I think ideally someone should have laughed at that straight away and said, no, there's no way we can possibly say that. So I think humor can actually be quite a healthy thing to have in a company.
I would 100% agree with you on Yorkshire Tea. I think what struck me is their use of, going back to what we were saying earlier, little P purpose, not big P purpose. Mm-hmm. But that idea of doing everything properly pulls everything together. And what they do is just stick consistently to this idea. You can execute that 1,000 times in 1,000 different ways, can't you? Mm-hmm. Rather than the idea of making the world better one cup at a time, or whatever the alternative might be. It's not what would we do in a world without purpose, is it? It's what we should be doing. If we think about the brand, not about this idea of changing the world and making the world a better place.
Yeah, I think it should be a kind of an exciting future to contemplate, in a way, the idea that we can actually shake off some of this worthiness around purpose and this seriousness and actually celebrate brilliant creativity. Doesn't all have to be funny, but yeah, just doing really strong creative ideas. You know, you could show that Yorkshire Tea campaign to someone in the 1950s or 60s, and that they would immediately recognise it as a great campaign. Yeah. Does all the things that great campaigns have always done. So yeah, I think we just need to celebrate that more. You know, really, a brand like Yorkshire Tea should have been winning all the black pencils and all the Grand Prix awards for the last decade. I think it's kind of strange that they haven't really.
But luckily, I think at least it's sold more tea.
Yeah.
Let's not forget that in all this.
Yeah, no, totally. And that's the other thing as well. It's not like Yorkshire Tea have done all that at the expense of becoming some kind of immoral, you know, unethical business. As far as I know, they're an extremely decent, honourable business that does good stuff, but they just don't go on about it. You know, that's not the point of their brand or their advertising.
So I am absolutely taking purpose from you, and I'm keeping it in here. While you are here, before you go, Nick, is there anything that you would like to return to the marketing world?
Yeah, well, I may be slightly cheating here, because I'm going to pick what I would see as the flip side of this argument, which is that I would just love to see a return of creativity. The specific thing I would like to haul back out of Room 101 would be the idea of creative awards awarding creativity. Which I actually
a novel
think,
idea.
Well, yeah, I certainly think it's not one that should ever have been in Route 101. But I do think that's the reality of what's happened in the last 10 years or so. And I think lots of people in the industry quietly recognise it. I occasionally get involved in awards judging at various places, and there's always this mood in the room that, oh yeah, but we need to award something that's kind of makes us look good and makes the industry feel good about itself. So, you know, if it's a brilliant brand identity, but it's for an airline, then that's kind of problematic. But if it's for, I don't know, some kind of, yeah, more purposeful feeling brand, then yes, let's favour that one. And I think it comes from maybe a good instinct sometimes that, you know, you want to kind of, you warm to good causes. Sometimes the ads are quite emotional and, you know, it feels a bit deeper somehow than just laughing at a funny ad. But I think what it's done is it's turned what should be our big kind of industry shop window where we celebrate all the brilliant stuff and we say to the world, look, this is what advertising can do. This is what creativity can do. And instead of actually genuinely celebrating the best stuff wherever it comes from and the full variety of it, I think we end up just pushing these kind of purpose projects to the front and saying, yeah, look, we're worthy and ethical. And no one really buys it, I don't think. Yeah, I would just love to see us getting a bit more. As I say, I would love to see Yorkshire Tea going up on stage rather than some kind of contrived ad that links the brand to autism or racism or, you know, whatever it is. There's something distasteful about it, I think, when these commercial brands enter this social realm just so that they can then enter it into 25 different categories that can or whatever. Do you have any experience of that or any view on that?
Yes, I do. And I think it's interesting what you're saying there about why doesn't an ad for a commercial purpose win an award? My experience is you hear it's a great idea. It's not an award-winning idea because it's not got that worthy message. I suppose what I'm interested in, I don't know why. Why hasn't that changed? Why do we all know about it? Why do we all talk about it? Why do people in agencies and in brands know that an idea will only win an award if it's for a worthy cause rather than for one that sells a hell of a lot of tea or mayonnaise? So why don't the awards change? Why isn't that being listened to?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think very, very slowly the message is maybe getting through, because this reached a kind of absurd peak in, I think the really peak year was 2022, when I think 17 of the 21 creative categories at Cannes went to obviously purpose-driven projects. And they're actually separate categories for purpose and social impact, which is fine, I think, if you're judging it on that. But these were actually creative categories that are supposed to be judged purely on craft and excellence of the idea and that kind of thing. And it's just been very common at DNAD and Cannes and all sorts of other places. I think there are deep reasons why it's been so hard to shift, because I think it kind of plays into the bigger purpose debate and why that's been so hard to shift. Because if you're being particularly harsh about it, you could say it's a kind of a brand laundering exercise for some of these big ad agencies and holding companies. It's really making money all year, doing the usual stuff for the usual clients who are all a mixed bag of oil companies or airlines or whatever they are. But then make sure you keep some budget aside every year to do like one project that's about the social issue of the day. And then you do some big stunt that only a big ad agency can really afford to do anyway. And you scoop the creative awards for that, and then you can go back to all the commercial clients and say, hey, we're the UK's number one creative agency or something. And the people who lose out, I think, they're actually often the smaller agencies, I think. You know, if it's really about the craft and the idea, then everyone enters those awards on the same level. I think when you make it about purpose and about social impact, it favours the kind of bigger agencies that can afford to do these essentially pro bono campaigns and then PR them to death and enter them in 25 categories. And so, yeah, I think it suits some of the bigger players, I think. I would like to see people get less patient with it, because I actually think it's almost defrauding the entrants as well. You know, I think you pay a very high fees these days to enter a creative scheme. You know, the judging criteria say you're going to be judged on the creative craft and the strength of the idea. And yet when you get into the awards room, they're actually judging you on, oh, well, we don't like that brand because they don't seem very sustainable. And yeah, that shouldn't be allowed. If that's the reason you're not getting awarded, you should get your money.
I also think it's a bit of a creative hack in a way, because it's easy to tap into an emotional well when you've latched onto an emotive subject matter, whatever that latest social cause might be, or whatever you can use to essentially piggyback on something that's already highly emotively charged, which is often done so in a way that's paper thin and disingenuous and doesn't actually represent the real world needs of that brand. But for the sake of a creative award entry, I'm going to create something that's charged with emotion by piggybacking onto a social issue, a societal issue, something else, which is hard to do if we're just trying to sell mayonnaise and tea.
Yeah, no, you said it very well. It reminds me as well of, I mean, fortunately, this was a bit before my time because I'm not that old, but in the 1980s, there was a move at award schemes to separate out charity ads, you know, into their own category, because people recognised that it was kind of easier, basically, to do a big, powerful, tear-jerking campaign for a charity. And lots of agencies were deliberately doing them for free so that they could enter awards. So they were hived off into their own category as a separate thing, which I think is perfectly fine. But at least those ads, even if they were pro bono ads done mainly to win awards, at least they were actually for charities. And yeah, they might have actually been getting some decent results for those charities. But the new thing now is, as you've just said, it's now doing the kind of social issues ads, which are awards friendly, but it's not even doing them for charities. It's doing them for a washing powder or something.
I think you iterate that really well in the book, where you talk about, is it the Pepsi campaign where Kendall Jenner comes out, strolls across and hands the can over to the police officer at the street protest?
Yeah. Very strange looking street protest where it's not really clear what the protest is about. Like, there's just people holding banners saying join the conversation and love, and they're all like ecstatically happy. And then, yeah, I kind of described the whole scene. A cellist joins in the march for some unknown reason. And then, yeah, Kendall Jenner.
I've never seen a cellist at a march.
Yeah. There's a brilliant Woody Allen meme, actually, where he's a cellist in a marching band. You have to see it, really. Anyway, it was a kind of famously absurd ad that came out in 2017, and it was withdrawn the next day. But I think, to be fair to people who are more serious about purpose, they would say, well, obviously that was a stupid example. But I do think that's where you end up if you push brands in this direction. You know, Pepsi did what Simon Sinek would have told them to do, or what any kind of purpose person would have told them to do. They kind of started with why. They somehow convinced themselves that what they're really here to do is to kind of unite people. And then it's a short step from there to saying, okay, so what if we have people divided by a protest march, and then we actually hand a can of Pepsi over, and that kind of unites people and diffuses the situation. And before you know it, you're doing this that goes down in history as one of the worst judge dads of all time.
I think, interestingly, every brand is here to save the world. I would say, or bring people together. Mm. That's the other one that seems to appear a lot in the purpose debate. We exist to bring people together.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's actually a funny dimension to the whole thing, because I actually think, in a way, by not being purposeful with a capital P, brands can actually bring people together, in the sense that, you know, they're a form of common ground. You know, you can buy Yorkshire tea whether you're a Conservative voter or a Labour voter or Brexit or Remainer. It kind of doesn't matter, because they're not a political brand. They don't really live in that space. And that's a nice thing, I think, about brands most of the time. But when brands get pushed by this purpose movement to kind of take on a stance around something, it can very quickly go wrong, you know. So, ironically, by trying to say, you know, we're truly here to unite people, Pepsi ended up, you know, dividing them.
So, Nick, I am going to take brand purpose from you, and I'm going to keep it. I am going to give you back creative awards that actually award creativity. You can distribute those to every marketing agency, every brand. But before you go, this podcast has one super fan, and that is my brother, who doesn't work in the industry. And he wanted to ask you a question. He wanted to know, if there was an actual road to hell, which road would it be, and what car would you be in?
Oh, God. It is a tricky one to answer. I think, on a topical note, I would have to say the car would be a bright pink Jaguar. I mean, it's not exactly a kind of purpose issue, that whole thing. I think there's a purpose tinge to the story. There's a slightly ridiculous sense in which Jaguar is trying to maybe connect with this elusive Gen Z that doesn't really exist. So, yeah, I think it would be a Jaguar, just for the comedy value. The road, I like roads in general, but I think I would say any road that kind of leads away from the north, which is, you know, my spiritual homeland, yours as well, I guess.
Mm, absolutely.
And maybe leads further towards London. So I might pick, I would go with the M. I'll tell you what, I'll go with the toll road on the M40. Yeah, I don't think we should be paying a toll to get to London faster. Quite anti-London sentiment there, by the way. I think London's a very fine city, but I think I'd rather be up here.
I think I would agree. Absolutely. And I have spent a very small period of time living in London, and I do love the place, but I would like to stay in the north. Nick, thank you for your time. How can people get hold of you? Where can they find your book?
Thank you for asking. Yeah, it's on a little bookshop called Amazon. You can go on there and search for The Road to Hell. You can also go to Waterstones and various other places and find it that way. NickAsbury.com if you want to see the kind of work I do. I have a Substack, nickasbury.substack.com, where I write long essays about various things. And all the social platforms seem to be in a weird place at the moment, but actually LinkedIn is the one where I'm probably most active right now.
Nick, thank you for coming in.
Thank you. I wish I'd known someone with your magical powers a few years ago. Would have saved me a lot of trouble.
Yes, many hours writing that book, I guess.
Yeah, totally.
So that was my conversation in Marketing Room 101 with Nick Asprey. If you enjoyed it, could you please leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts? Because doing so tells Spotify and Apple, etc. to introduce more people to the show, which means I can attract the best possible guests for you to listen to. So it's kind of doing yourself a favour.